This is part of a ministry that I have with the Pacific Northwest Synod of the LCA and the North Pacific District of the ALC. So, I welcome you. I appreciate your taking your time from the sun and coming in. This is good. This ministry is an expression of the reaching out of Lutheran Church out beyond what is traditionally Lutheran. And it's an expression of the desire to see others as neighbors. And I think that there are many, many Lutheran people who are ready to build relationships with Indians. And in fact, who have, over the years, had relationships with Indian people, relationships that led them to some real close friendships, some sharing of spirituality, and certainly a lot of strong advocacy of work by the Lutheran churches, the different synods. And so I sort of inherited some of that history, and I'm really proud to be a part of it. Maybe we could just stand up with and begin with a word of prayer. And face the east. I send a voice to the east, celebrating the season of spring. I send a voice to the east, celebrating the birth of life, the beginning of new things. I celebrate the children, the infants, the seeds that are being planted. I send a voice to the east, celebrating the warm winds, the gentle rain, the sun that warms and renews us and gives us new life. Let us turn to the south. I celebrate the seasons of summer, the warmth, the gentle darkness, the stars. I celebrate the season of growth and maturity in life, the young, the new families, parents with children. I celebrate the season of summer with its growth and fruitfulness, its fertility and abundance. Let us turn to the west. I celebrate the season of adulthood, of maturity, of leadership, the season of life when we extend our vision beyond our own generation. And we look to the past for understanding, and we look to the future for direction. I celebrate the season of autumn, the season of harvest, the season of change, the season where the winds are cooler and where perspectives become broader. I celebrate this season as I face the west. Let's turn to the north. I celebrate the season of winter, the time of aging, the time when our life on earth is ending. I celebrate the wisdom that comes even as our energy declines. I celebrate the vision that comes from those who are looking beyond the end of this life onto the next. I celebrate the cold and the darkness, and the time of turning inward. I celebrate the season of winter. Please turn to the east. You might want to focus on Mother Earth and celebrate with me life, your life. The sacredness of your life, the sacredness of life
around us, the trees and plants, all the living green things. Celebrate the life that comes from the waters and the earth. Celebrate the life that is within you, the flame that burns and sustains you, the life that you have received as a child of the generations. Think of yourself as that which has inherited the life of the seventh generation before you. In fact, you have carried on the life of the 77th generation before you. And I invite you to celebrate with me your sacred life. I invite you to look up and celebrate with me the next life. Celebrate the promise of life after death on this earth. Celebrate with me the hope that you have, if this moment is your last moment on earth, that there will be for you a time of healing, a time when there is abundance and prosperity for you, a time when your life goes on in the life of your children, in the life of the generations that follow you, even to the life of the 77th generation ahead. Celebrate with me the future, the times that are coming. Celebrate the Creator that has given all of these good things. Before I begin on my continuing my series, I wanted to share with you a few things that are open to you as a part of the ministry of the Lutheran Church. How many of you, anybody here a pastor? Ordained minister? Okay. I think maybe this stuff is even more important for those who are members of the Lutheran Church or even other denominations. There is a process going on now, which is the merger into the new Lutheran Church. And the reason I lift it up as part of what is a minority ministry is that the structures and systems of the church are being changed. Now just think about that for a minute. The life of the church is being, for a period of time now, in the next 2 years, considered. And doors are open for change and for input. And I have reserved for you in the library, on the reserve shelf, this study on the progress report number 5, a narrative description of the new Lutheran Church. And I would invite you to take some time to learn more about this process. There is, in association with it, an opportunity to tell the church, the new church, the design committee for the new church and the commission for the new church, what you want to see happening in your Lutheran church. And I've been involved in the process, and while some may be negative or not hopeful, I think for the lives of people who are not now really heard in the church, it's a real opportunity. And I just wanted to take just a minute to tell you about this and invite you to take a look at it. Kind of an interesting document. The statement of faith is something that can be a seed for your time up here. Think about your faith. What is your faith? What do you believe? And how do you express that in terms of a church and in terms of a church in a world? I just wanted to share that with you. I have a couple other things to share. If you're LCA, there is a statement that was adopted at the Toronto Convention. It's called Inclusiveness and Diversity, Gifts of God. This is a declaration of a commitment, a declaration and commitments, which the Lutheran Church in America has made, and then has sent these down to synods and local congregations, women's organizations, as a project for the next 3 years anyway, to implement this declaration. The declaration declares that the Lutheran Church is dedicated to celebrating the diversity of the membership and to acknowledge it, that it's that the Lutheran Church is a diverse group of people. It is dedicated to confronting racism as a sin. It is dedicated to increasing fellowship amongst the members, the congregations, and churches. Dedicated to proclaiming and celebrating the gospel, not only to and with within our church, but with God's community throughout the world. Dedicated to pursuing racial justice through individual and corporate actions. Developing leadership that reflects and responds to the diversity of our membership. Reorganizing, in some cases, the church so that all members are represented in and served by the decisions that the church makes. And it is dedicated to monitoring and being accountable for our life together so that it becomes a more inclusive church that celebrates its diversity. And that's, I think this is a very important statement for the church. And but a statement is a statement, and it will have no effect unless it is implemented. And I think it won't be implemented unless the people are open to think about it. And that's another reason why I lift this up to all of you. It's the result of many years of work and a process that began in as early as the 60s with the civil rights movement. And I think it's an important step for the new church and for the life of our congregations. And I just wanted to share that with you. Along the same line, the ALC has a document that is just out. It's called Visions of an Inclusive Church, this particular edition of it. It has been out in sort of working report form for a while. And this is a document that is very effective in describing what it would be like if the Lutheran Church became more inclusive and was able to celebrate its diversity. So, as a part of my ministry, I lift these up to you as something that's happening in your Lutheran churches that that is really important for the lives, particularly of the minority people in the church. And I think it's an issue, it's something that is an avenue towards justice to the rest of the world. In other words, we have to do justice everywhere. And we begin, when we begin to do justice within ourselves and within our own congregations, then we have some energies created to do justice to the world. I guess that's all I'll say about that right now. Okay. I started out before we turned the tape on with where are you and what is your experience. Has anybody here lived on an Indian reservation? Anybody have an Indian relative? Grandmother?
Well, we think John might be part Indian.
But it's not for sure. No. Yeah. Well, actually, someone said the mean or the average between a European and an Indian is an American, which I thought was rather a fascinating statement. And some of you who are American and return to Europe, if that was your original homeland heritage out of which your culture, what you've inherited came from, know that you're not European. There's something there that has really changed from Europe during the process of living in America. Okay, that's enough about that. The task that I have in the church, as I said before, is a ministry to the Lutheran Church. And it's a ministry that invites people to begin to think about building relationships with Indian people. Not defined in terms of the old ways that we would think of as a missionary mission work, but think about Indian people. And so I'm doing 15 sessions over June, really, on Indian people. And I've this will be the fourth one. And the first text that I'm using for the first 8 sessions is this one. It's called American Indians and Christian Missions. And it's written by Henry Warner Bowden. And he comes out of, he's a professor of religion at Rutgers University. And this is part of a series called Studies in Cultural Conflict. And I selected this book and another book for the next 8 sessions because of some of the developmental work that I'm doing in the ministry. This book tells a history of some of the earliest interactions between Indian groups and church people, missionaries. And I started the first session with the Indians of the Southwest and the missionaries that came to work with them, the Spanish friars. In the second session, we talked about the French missionaries. Let's see, now I know what I did. I skipped. The first session is about the very ancient Indian cultures that existed around all across this land before anybody came. That's what happened. I skipped over the first session. The second session, then, was about the Pueblos and the Spanish missionaries. And the third session was about the Huron, which is in the Great Lakes region, some of your Minnesotans, your area. There were a particular group of Native peoples that lived in the Great Lakes region, and their experience with the Jesuit French missionaries.
James, would you spell it?
What, Huron? H-U-R-O-N. Okay. So that's sort of a covering of the topics that have gone on so far on the tapes that were done already. I'm doing something that's new for me in terms of taping, but more than that, I'm doing something that's new for me in terms of my training and background. I have a master's degree in Indian education. And in order to be Janice and go to school and get a master's degree, I learned to take myself, my own way of doing things, and set that aside and do things the way the school said you do this, and this is how you teach, and this is what you do. And since I feel like I'm of an age that I can do what I want to now, I'm letting go of that process of doing things the way the school taught me. I say that as an introduction to a process that I'll be using for the next hour, which is not what we call a linear projection. I've done my introduction and I've tried to bring you in, but I would like to kind of shift gears now and do something maybe a little bit differently in teaching. I would like us to kind of get into our imaginations a little bit, okay? It's easy to do here because we're in just a really good setting. The overall title of my whole 15-tape series is called Journey on an Eagle's Back. The theme for this summer at Holden is called Under God's Wing. And it comes out of that image in the Bible about God as a mother eagle. Have you experienced eagles, anybody? They live at the top of the highest trees. On the top of the highest cliffs. This is the kind of country that they look for. And so the vision of an eagle is very broad and global and sort of all-inclusive. Another thing that an eagle does is it builds a great big nest. It's kind of a flat, sort of ugly sort of thing. And it has its, in fact, you could consider this little circle we have here as a nest. And it has, it's made from sticks, and then it lays its eggs in the middle. And it brings food up to the eaglets. And when they get to be a certain size, the mother eagle, and you can just visualize, you know, just think about these tall trees around here. She takes the eaglet to the edge of the nest and pushes them off. You can imagine how that is. And I think some of us feel that way when we have to do some issues of faith and issues of religion. We feel like somebody's, you know, pushing us off the top of a tall tree. But the interesting thing about an eagle is if that eaglet cannot fly, what the eagles do is swoop down underneath them. And they have the broad back and the broad wings, and they just catch them right underneath and carry them back up. And it's an incredible image, I think, under God's wing. I've really had fun playing with that. So for the next half hour, we're going to get on the eagle's back, and we're going to begin a spiral journey. And the journey will carry us to the title that's on the board there, the Massachusetts Indians. Okay. And where they lived is in northeastern United States, in the farthest northeastern area of the United States, the New England, the area of Plymouth Colony. And so you can guess what missionaries I'm going to talk about. The English. Okay. So we're going to get on an eagle's back, and we're going to go back in time. And this is an area of the United States bordered by the Atlantic Ocean. And an area that's familiar to you if you've ever been to Cape Cod or Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Connecticut, any of that area. Okay? Are you with me? These people, the Massachusetts people, lived in large groups. There were a very vigorous and healthy group of native peoples in this whole area. The Massachusetts were the furthest eastern, right on Boston Bay in that area. So they were the native peoples that were first contacted. A little further west of them, the Nipmucks, Nipmucks, to the south near Cape Cod, the Wampanoags, Wampanoags, to the west of that, and I'm not from Rhode Island, and I don't know how to say this, Narragansetts. Narragansetts. And it'll be interesting for you as you take hikes or work on pottery to think, why are these names so unfamiliar? The Pequots and the Mohicans are some of the native names in this group. So you get a vision from our eagle's back of the Atlantic Ocean. The abundance, you know, the abundance of fish on the bank, the fishing just off the coast there, the beautiful Chesapeake Bay and the beautiful bays this is on the Eastern Flyway. Just visualize the millions of birds. This is the beautiful hardwood forest area, a land of tremendous wildlife, wild turkey, deer, bear, elk. It was rich, very fruitful, abundant land, not terribly difficult to live in. Population estimates are that there were about 150,000 natives living in this area. The one tribe that I'm talking about near Boston, the Massachusetts, had about 21,000 people. The Wampanoag, just south of them, had another 21,000. These estimates are made in the early 1600s, but unfortunately, whether or not they're accurate is really irrelevant, because within, and I think it's 20 years, half of all those 150,000 people died. Does anybody want to, anybody who wasn't here last time want to suggest how they died?
Disease, that's
exactly right. All the diseases that that came to the New World from Europe, fevers, chickenpox, childhood diseases, things to which these natives had never been exposed, decimated the populations. And so you begin the story with tremendous suffering. Just they landed and the disease spread ahead of them. In 1617 and 1619, some unknown infection, I don't really know what it was, swept the area, and the people were devastated by this. This all happens before the development of the Plymouth colony, so it's kind of interesting to understand how really weakened the people were even before the settlers arrived. They have been existing for centuries on a very sort of balanced hunting and gathering economy that had also some subsistence farming. So their lifestyle was like this. And sort of as you flying over this area, and you kind of wipe out all that population, if you've ever flown over the East Coast, just kind of wipe that out and see this beautiful hardwood forest and these really beautiful lands. And what you see is you see native peoples who, let's see, they would begin in the spring with clearing land and planting. And then they would leave their crops and they would go to the coast and to the rivers, and they would fish and gather shellfish and take the subsistence harvest from that. They would move back to their crops. Let's see. Later on, they would move back and harvest in the fall. They would have this harvesting of crops. They've had cut down the trees and made a clearing and planted their crops. So they would have a harvest in the fall, and then the families would break up and go and spread out in a broader way to hunt all winter and survive through the winter. This is where the word wigwam comes from. They had the bark houses that were really quite well adapted to this lifestyle, this moving lifestyle. But it was not a disorganized life. You need to understand some of the relationships that were going on. These people were primarily patriarchal organized, and they were ruled under headmen called sachems, S-A-C-H-E-M-S, sachems. And they were leaders, but you need to understand the nature of their culture. A leader was only a leader as long as he made sense, and as long as you wanted to follow him, as long as you agreed with what he said. So a person would show by wisdom and leadership ability and a pulling together ability that he was worth following. And as long as he demonstrated his abilities, the people would follow him. But they always had the individual choice of doing whatever they wanted to. And so it was kind of a balance between paying attention to a leader, working together,
But in the bottom line, doing what you wanted to do and what you chose. And that even applied to war, warfare. You could call for a war. You could call for a war. But if somebody or some clan did not agree with you, they would not necessarily have to go and fight with you. When the first settlers saw this lifestyle of these Algonquin-speaking peoples, they thought these people were lazy. And this book lifts up kind of an interesting explanation of that. What these observers failed to recognize was the great respect for personal initiative that undergirded and encouraged such behavior. This, what they were labeling as, quote, lazy, seemed dissolute, they say, badly organized to whites, because they had been brought up in a system where you systematically organized industrious activity that was really important to the people who landed in this area. And when they went to see what the Indians were doing, they were just not reflecting that value. So they used words like lazy. However, they were simply free to choose their own objectives and to set their own pace. If they wanted to hunt, if they felt like hunting, they would hunt. If they didn't want to do something, they didn't do it. They had enormous personal choice and independence. However, once they decided to do something, they worked at it with great energy, self-denying concentration. They were not a lazy people, but they were very independent and very free to choose what they wanted to do. Okay. You're seeing a people who are in a particular relationship with the land, and that relationship is supported by their spiritual system. They have a sense of spirit in these forms around them. The word is Manitouic. Manitouic, it means the sacredness of everything. And so when they did something, like if they were going to hunt, they would pray about it. When they shot the arrow, they would speak to the spirit of the animal that they were killing and saying, you know, I wouldn't do this if I didn't really need to eat. And thank you for making yourself available to me. They had a sense that if they expressed their beliefs and if they followed their rituals, that life would be good to them. If they were remembered the sacredness of what they did, life would be good to them. And it was not only foolish, but it was bad theology, you might say, or it was bad religion not to consider everything sacred. It was suspicious behavior, maybe even witchcraft, to mistreat, like if you had killed a bear, to be irrespectful of that would be dangerous to the whole group, because it would be ignoring the sacredness of this spirit. And so they had a sense that if something was wrong in their life, it was because of their failures in their sacred ways. And they had a sense in terms of the leaders who would cure, would help to make people well. So you can imagine what happens when this disease comes through and they can't make them well. So they had lost some faith in their leadership already. Okay. All right. They had a whole group of sacred beings. And one of them is Manitou, the Great Spirit. Okay. But in writing the history of their great spirit, it is believed that some non-Indian interpretation has been applied to what they called great spirit. They acknowledge the existence of a creator spirit that they associated in some ways with sky, but probably in writing about that, most of the people who wrote about it were not Indian, and they read into this belief of great spirit probably more of a monotheistic, godlike thing than was really truly there. Their stories tell about their beliefs, and the stories that exist today, told from the descendants of those people, do not indicate the same kind of great spirit Jehovah connection that has been written or was written about in these years. Okay. Feel like you've kind of got a sense of these people? Any questions about their life or what I've described to you?
I've got one question. You were talking about Manitou?
Yes.
Was that just an Indian belief of that area? Or was it all Indians that had that, the great spirit?
The Manitou concept is just particular to this. Although most Indian groups have some ways of describing a sort of single overarching great energy, a creator energy.
Would their religious beliefs differ then from group to group?
Tremendously. Their creation stories were not too really important in their lives. Other Indian cultures have tremendous importance on creation stories, but these people do not have that real focus on creation stories. And you notice I didn't talk a lot about death rituals. Their practices after death were... Life was pretty good, and that after death would be about the same, and you didn't have to get real excited about handling the dead or doing anything with the dead in a great important way, and that's different from some other Indian groups. Okay. What I've tried to do as you experience this on the back of an eagle is to let you sort of see down onto these people and maybe hear some of the sounds of their life. And as you're listening, I hope you're bringing that back to you in a spiral, touching on maybe the images that you've ever had. I think about the last of the Mohicans and by the shores of Gichigumi. I don't know what you've got inside of you that connects with the Indians in this area. But it's there, and as you hear this, I want you to be able to hear whatever is inside of you, too. That's another part of this spiral dance that we're doing. I really would like you to lift that up as an image that we've taken off, and we've sort of danced around, and we're coming back and touching our own inner selves and going back. And another time in your life, I hope that you will be out into this area, and when you're there, that your eyes will be sensitive to see the images that are quote Indian in that area, and that you'll hear these beautiful names and understand the connection between these names and the peoples who live there, and you'll ask yourself, you know, where are they? Are they there? If you want to learn more about this region, I suggest that you subscribe to a newspaper that's called Akrasasni Notes. And you can get it in most major public libraries. And it's by some of the people, there are articles in there that are written by some of the people who still live in this area.
So there are still these Indians?
I mean, I have this vision that, you know, all the Indians east of, like,
Minnesota that there aren't any left. But.
There is within, I would say, this is, I can't really prove this, but I would say that within 200 miles of every place in America, there is an Indian community. Every place in America. There are remnants, survivors, people who carry on. And I would guess within 200 miles. Perhaps there are places where it's, you know, maybe the distance is different, but most people don't realize that Indian people are everywhere. And that's one of my jobs in the church, to share that information.
Would you say those people, I guess especially on the East Coast, are they living any sort of identifiable Indian lifestyle or?
Definitely, definitely, definitely. Real interesting what's happening. But I do want to take a few minutes to tell you what happened to them at the hands of the Puritans and how that might have happened. And the reason I want to do this is because it teaches us a couple of things. One, when we can look at the Puritan perspective in relationship to Indians, I think we get some sense of American tradition in relationships to other cultures. That if you, you know, again, to go back to the image of being on an eagle's back, listen to the sounds of the Puritans' voices as they relate to Indians. And you'll hear some things that you still hear today. And when you hear the impact and effect of these positions on the lives of these people, it might make you stop and think about some of these kinds of positions and the impact on lives around the world. And maybe when I do this, you'll understand a little bit more about what I mean. I don't want to take too long in doing this, but just, okay, very quickly, the Puritans landed in this area, and if you remember, they were leaving England, and what they were doing was creating a sacred place, a place where people were really true believers, and they would live a sanctified life. They had a theology that taught that there was an act of God that had been happening in a human being's life that bestowed upon that person grace and salvation. And if you didn't have that act of God, forget it. And the thing is that they did have it. And they landed on the shore to express it. Now they had to prove to each other that they had it, so they had to live a very sanctified life. They spent a lot of time doing theology and reading and paying attention to everybody else to be sure that everybody who was there was living a sanctified life, because that was essential to demonstrate that you had this gift of grace. You were really out of luck if you didn't have it. There was no way that you could get it. There was nothing you could do. There was no way to overcome the idea, if God hadn't already chosen you for salvation, forget it. So you need to understand that, because once they had decided that this person was not chosen, well, this person was going to live eternity in hell anyway, they didn't even need to live in today. It's a position. Having once shown that you are saved, and having decided that that whoever is not saved, you don't need to treasure their life. And they brought this with them, this concept with them, because of attitudes toward the Irish. The English had viewed the Irish, who followed a separate religion and culture, as barbarians. And there was no way that the Irish would accept the advantages of British control. The idea that they brought with them was that since they were sanctified, and since they were right, unfortunately, they believed in an inherent superiority. Now, the Irish never accepted that. They never wanted to give up their language or culture. And they had this history of brokenness between the English and the Irish. And when they came to the United States, to this land here, they brought that same sense of superiority of English life. Remember, they left England because of their unwillingness to compromise on matters of belief. And they had that same position when they came here. They had no desire to preserve any element of native culture. Being sanctified meant being English and sanctified meant living a certain prescribed way, being able to read, building houses a certain way, growing crops a certain way, everything, every aspect of life had a particular rule. So they had no desire to preserve anything of the native people. They saw the unregenerate, sinful, deserving of censure. They had a possibility that the Indians could be saved. They believed theologically in grace for the Indian. But the Indian who had this grace, this gift of grace, had to demonstrate it by adopting totally an English style of life. Okay. And I'm not going to go through the different processes, but they did, in fact, get a very few Indian people to become Christian, to adopt an English style of life. The ones who didn't were chased away, pushed east, and that will have impact all the way across the United States. But there were a few. Later, some of those who were not Christian return, you know, to attack and drive these people out. This only gave them evidence to support their already established belief that they couldn't trust Indians, that Indians were nothing but sinful, and they, you know, they use this kind of language. And you may have been hearing this as you were raised. And you need to understand where those voices come from. And so what they did then is they turned on the Christian Indians. Having been under attack by non-Christian Indians, they decided in a kind of a mentality, a siege mentality, that they couldn't trust the ones who were Christian. And so the result of missionary work by the Puritans is first the conversion of a group of Indian people who settled down and built homes and houses, then the attack during the French and Indian Wars on the Puritan communities, and the turning of the Puritans on to what they call the praying Indians, and they were driven out. They were driven out totally. And the Indians who were not Christianized, the Wampanoags, attacked. The praying Indians remained peacefully in their towns, and they had built 7 towns of Christian Indians. As it turned out, the Wampanoags in their attack, and these Indians were really expressing a Christian perspective, and so they're very peaceable, and they didn't really defend themselves in a great way. It turned out, though, that the Indians attacking the praying Indians was much less dangerous than the Puritan. The fearful whites and these Christian Indians had even fought the Wampanoags to try to protect not only their society, but also the other Puritan villages. But fear led to blanket condemnation, and the missionaries who were working with the praying Indians could not counteract the anti-Indian prejudice. And by June of 1675, the authorities ordered all the praying Indians to be concentrated into five towns, quote, for their own security. They confiscated their weapons and forbid them to hunt. They would not let them fight alongside of them, even though they did. But in 1675, the General Court established what amounted to concentration camps for these Christian Indians. Many of them fled, but most of them were willing to submit, and so they were confined on Deer Island in Boston Harbor. Nearly 500 of them endured the winter of 1675 to 76 on an island, a barren terrain, without food, clothing, or shelter. By late spring, the colonial authorities relocated them near Cambridge, but this prison life had taken a dreadful toll. The mission program, the Puritan mission, was in shambles, virtually no recovery. As few as 180 members of the villages, and only 10 of those 180 actually remained active in the church. A reservation system lumped these people together, and it's kind of a sad story. It says here only the number of Christian Indians declined from 166 in 1749 to only 20 in 1797, and in 1855 there was only one Christian Indian left. New England, where white expansion relentlessly pushed the dwindling cluster of adherents into cultural oblivion, the missions never regained their former vitality. It's kind of a sad story. And I think it's a story which, as we hear it, also resonates some of the continuing attitudes and prejudices against Native people, not only here, but as you listen to some of that language, you hear some attitudes, American attitudes, toward Native peoples around the world that continue to be a problem, I think, in our foreign policy. So, we've soared past, and we need to maybe think about how we personally feel about this story. And we also need to hear that that isn't the end of the story. This is, like I said, 1855. Since 1855, you remember this story was about the Christian Indians, and there are those who survived this whole process, communities. And so there are communities of Native peoples in these areas that did survive. There are very few actual reservations in that area. There are a couple, and I'll be talking about them. But they do live in communities, and in many ways they do preserve as much of the ancient stories and traditions as are still there. And they adapt, and they have adapted to a lifestyle that focuses on survival for today and survival for the future. There's a real powerful vitality to their lives, and I think a surge of self-understanding and awareness that leads them to recover some of their traditions and heritage.
Are you saying that is different? I mean, they are especially that way compared to other Indians in the United States, or are you just saying?
I think it's a move that is happening all. It's not like it happens in every Indian life, but when you take the whole of the community life, where you have different individuals at different places, but as a general thrust, there is vitality and life, and there is healing, and there is a standing straighter and a looking back and a looking ahead energy. Yeah.
I think I heard you say that there are these tribes in Northeast, they specialized or they honored the sacred, considered most everything sacred. And the way I got sized up, there's not that much that is actually sacred to them anymore. That's basically why they managed to hang around, right?
I think when I talk about a healing process, I think there were groups of people who preserved these traditions, but individually, they have been forced to experience a moving away from that, and then I think a rediscovering of the concepts of sacredness. In other words, in order to survive, especially on the East Coast, you have to live in a society that does not consider everything sacred. And having survived, however, and having matured and come to a place, they do tend to turn back to that basic life position, to rediscover for themselves.
Lots of sacred honorings or beliefs out in the Dakotas, but they think they reluctantly, foolishly hang on to their sacred, or I mean many of their ideas, because they have a pretty clear vision of God's sacred world all wrong. And they reluctantly, foolishly hang on to some independence, for example.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by foolishly.
Well, drugs have been an influence on a great many people, even minor drugs, I mean, even their own brand. But I consider some, when you consider that 9 out of 10 alcoholics are Indian, then I question what their wisdom is.
Okay, so you're lifting up that you've experienced Indian people as having a problem with alcohol and drugs. Actually, statistically, there is not that great of a difference between Indians and non-Indians. It's just that Indian drinking is more visible because of their culture, whereas the non-Indian is often drinking in alone or in social settings. But the number of alcoholics is not that different. Alcoholism is a terrible problem all over the country, no matter what race and culture. But their social patterns of Indian life, including a tremendous poverty and homelessness, makes Indian alcoholism more visible. I invite you to if this is the last time you're here, to explore who are the Indian people where you live. And Holden Village is in the process of exploring who the Chelan Indians were and what has happened to them and what is their history, and make advantage of any opportunities that you have to experience Indian people, whether it's their stories, their literature, their art. There are many events in Indian communities to which the public is invited. There are Indian people within our congregations, and I would also invite you to become an advocate for the lives of these people. There are many things that the Lutherans and Lutheran congregations and Lutheran synods can do that would be very important in the lives of Indian people, as they have done in the past.
We have an Indian woman in Madison. She's Roman Catholic by faith, but she spoke to my Sunday school class a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just fascinating. She told her during the Second World War of communicating, this is the old medicine man,
mm-hmm.
of communicating with a soldier on one of the islands, Iwo Jima, I think,
mm-hmm.
communicating with this person by the medicine man. Just fascinating to hear her talk.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't say that this actually happened. She's just telling us what did happen.
Mm-hmm.
She thought.
Mm-hmm. I'll be talking a little bit about some of the modern Indian traditions on Friday, Indian religious experiences. And there are several Christian and traditional faith systems across the United States. I'll be talking about some of them. Yes?
Where are you from originally?
I'm Lakota, from Pine Ridge, South Dakota, which is the Oglala Sioux people, and I have not lived there, but that is the tribe that I'm related to. I am basically an urban Indian, and I have lived in many different places, including an Athabascan Indian village and an Eskimo Yupik village. I think it's just a reflection of the fact that denial of the obsessive illnesses is a big deal in this country. People deny their own obsessive illnesses and see those of others. Clearly, alcoholism, drug addiction are terrible problems to the non-Indian culture in this country. And sometimes I think that they pay so much attention to it because they don't want to pay attention to the problems that exist in Middle America.
Where did you grow up? What city?
I grew up in the mountains in Colorado in a little tiny town called Evergreen. And then I came out here in the Pacific Northwest in 1960 and lived on Bainbridge and Vashon Island.
You said you were from where in South Dakota?
My tribal home is Pine Ridge, South Dakota. And I have many, many relatives there.
A few weeks ago, I'm a farmer. I was dragging the cornfield, and I found an axe. Beautifully shaped. It doesn't seem to be scarred or the plow or anything else. It's in good shape. But it weighs 8 pounds. Can you tell me what we would do with an instrument like that? How would they carry it to grain a buffalo or wood with it?
And what state do you live in?
Minnesota.
Minnesota. And it's a hand shaped axe?
I believe it looks to me like it's more or less accidental shape, the main shape, but there's the groove for
mm-hmm.
the thongs and the wood going around it, so it's definitely an implement of some kind.
Hmm. Fascinating.
I've seen them in the museum.
Uh-huh.
The same way. Not quite as big. It's 8 pounds.
Yeah, that's really big.
Whether it's dog Travis or whatever, it would be off the general trade.
Uh-huh. Gosh, I don't know for sure. I think it would be a fascinating journey for you to take it in to a local historical association, or even better, to a tribal archive and ask the local tribe what they know about that. You get a chance to meet Indian people, and they're always very happy to talk to you.